Just a warning before we start, some people may find parts of this podcast distressing. I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. Last Monday, after weeks of mounting anger between Palestinians and Israeli police, the first missiles were fired. Hamas, the Islamist militant group that rules inside Gaza and has fought three wars with Israel since 2007, had launched rocket attacks. Israel responded with airstrikes. Despite international calls for calm, the violence has escalated. The skies above Israel are filled with the sounds of air raid sirens, and at night are lit up by volleys of rockets. Gaza City is under heavy bombardment. On Wednesday, a reporter in Gaza captured the moment a building was destroyed.
I can't. If you can hear me, I can't.
But this isn't just a fight between military forces. In recent days, racist attack mobs have spread throughout Israel in the worst Arab-Jewish communal violence seen in years. Today, are Israel and Palestine on the brink of another war? It's Monday, the 17th of May. Rachel Humphreys is a producer and presenter on Today in Focus, The Guardian's global news podcast, where this episode first aired on Friday.
Oliver Holmes, you're The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent. What is behind the escalation of tensions between Israel and Palestine over the last few weeks?
Well, what is behind escalations of tensions here at any stage, really, which is the occupation of the Palestinian territories, which has been going on for more than five decades now. And that flares up in bouts of violence every now and again. And at the moment, we've had one which is particularly bad. And that's down to a number of factors all culminating together at once.
And a lot of this violence originally began in Jerusalem. Why?
Jerusalem is an extremely important city for billions of people around the world. It's a religious center for Christians and Muslims and Jews. And with regards to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, it has always been the sort of the core of the issue and a really symbolic and emotional core. In the old city of Jerusalem, you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam. To a lot of non-Muslims, they'll be more familiar with the Dome of the Rock, which is a shrine next to it. And you'll know that, obviously, because of the glinting golden dome. But that compound is built on top of what Jews refer to as the Temple Mount, which is a huge area in the old city. And below that is the Western Wall, which is the holiest site where Jews can pray. So there's always been tension about this, and especially since Israeli forces captured the whole of Jerusalem, including its majority Palestinian neighborhoods. There have been huge tensions around access to this site, ownership of this site, and life in the Holy City.
The past month has been Ramadan, the holy month for Muslims. How has that played into rising tensions?
At nighttime, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been going to the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. And normally they gather after their evening prayers on the steps outside Damascus Gate, which is an ancient gate on the walls of the old city. And police put barricades there to prevent them gathering. And as tensions have risen, there have been protests and Palestinians have thrown rocks and shoes at Israeli police who are around. And the police have responded with stun grenades and tear gas. And this sort of reached ahead over the weekend when police twice moved into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and clashed with protesters. And on Monday morning when that happened, they moved right in and people were inside the mosque and the stained glass windows of the mosque were broken, and there were videos coming out of stun grenades exploding within the mosque. And that really ramped things up. because it's such an emotional centre for many people's lives.
This sounds like a heavy-handed response from the Israeli police, but is this typical? Do tensions often flare between them and worshippers at the mosque?
They do. And the last bout of violence that people are referring to is in 2017, when Israeli authorities had plans to put metal detectors and security cameras around the compound.
For many Muslims around the world, that represents Israeli encroachment on a very important holy site.
That really upset people, and that led to weeks of sort of sporadic violence.
Another day of tensions, arrests and scuffles around the entrance to Al-Aqsa Mosque.
So Palestinians have long complained of brutal police tactics.
Oliver, another factor playing into all of this is a dispute in a neighbourhood called Sheikh Jarrah. Can you explain why this is part of the story?
Sheikh Jarrah is a neighbourhood very close to the old city, and it's in East Jerusalem. It's a majority Palestinian neighbourhood, and it's quite hilly. It's a sort of middle-class Palestinian neighbourhood. There's football pitches and playgrounds. There's also Israeli settlers who live there, and they have managed to get there through sort of discreetly buying houses or building new buildings. And so there's been tension in that neighbourhood. These Jewish settlers claim that they owned the land that these Palestinians lived on before 1948, when Israel was created in the midst of a conflict with Arab states and Palestinians. Jews who can prove a title to a property from before 1948 can claim back those properties in Jerusalem.
Are you yelling at me? I didn't do this. I didn't do this.
But
it's easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No, no one is allowed to steal it, ya ammi.
No similar law exists for Palestinians who lost homes in West Jerusalem, which was part of Israel, now and before 1967.
And the issue surrounding Sheikh Jarrah in this case has circulated around evictions. Can you tell us about those, Oliver? When did this all start?
This has been a long, long-running case, but it's come to a head now because the Jerusalem District Court has ruled in favour of these Israeli settlers and said that they can take these houses. And these Palestinian families, which includes potentially, you know, several hundred people, these large families, face eviction. And on Monday this week, the Supreme Court was going to rule to decide whether those Palestinians could appeal that decision. And that's what really added to tensions here.
These evictions are part of an intensification by Benjamin Netanyahu's government to expand settlements. Why is he pushing for this now?
If you ask the Israeli government about this case, they'll say this is a private legal dispute. But the context with which it comes in is that Palestinians feel increasingly squeezed, not only in Jerusalem, where settlers are moving more and more into their neighbourhoods, but also in the occupied West Bank, where there are hundreds of thousands of settlers, and Palestinians are sort of mostly confined to small urban enclaves. And this has really intensified over the past few years. And there's a feeling of hopelessness among Palestinians that certainly grew during the Trump administration.
I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Washington implemented a series of policies to sort of boost Israel's claim to not only Jerusalem, but also the wider area.
What is the feeling from Israelis about resettlement?
Israel is a very diverse country and people have different views, but there is a strong sentiment among the right wing in Israel, which has been in power for many, many years and is extremely influential, that the occupied territories should be sort of a permanent part of Israel. Israel has been in a political crisis for over 2 years. It's held four elections since 2019. The prime minister is currently battling cases of criminal corruption in court, and he denies the charges, but it's affected his image. And there have been calls from his sort of traditional political partners on the right and the far right to act with a more heavy hand when it comes to Gaza and also Palestinians in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. In the latest election in March, an alliance of far-right parties, including sort of hardline nationalists who want to expel Arabs from the country, made it into parliament. So they've really been emboldened. And in general, Israelis support their government's claim to Jerusalem, the entire city, as the capital of the country, despite the fact that this isn't internationally recognized. And Palestinians hope that East Jerusalem may become part of a future state.
And what about Palestine? You know, what is the political situation there? And does that also play a role in all of this?
Palestinians haven't had a proper vote since 2006. And when I say vote, I'm talking about voting for the Palestinian Authority, which is this body that was created in the 1990s with the intention of turning into an actual government at some point, and it never did. And the occupation continued. It has some powers. It has kind of limited self-rule. But when you look at polls, it's extremely unpopular. And so is its leader, Mahmoud Abbas. Palestine was due to have elections this year, but they were cancelled. And this has added sort of additional frustration, I think, for Palestinians who feel they can't even vote in elections for this largely powerless body. So it's certainly added to tensions, and it's added to tensions between Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas, who are sort of political rivals. Hamas were expected to do well in a possible election, so that certainly made things worse.
And then on Monday, everything came to a head in Jerusalem. Why was that, and what happened?
So Monday, there was a series of provocative events that were all going to happen at once. One of them was the Sheikh Jarrah evictions ruling in the Supreme Court. And there were huge concerns that it was going to intensify the violence. And so just a day before, the government asked the Supreme Court if it could become party to the case. And basically that was a tactic to get the case delayed. And the Supreme Court came back and said that they would give the government 3 or 4 weeks to do that. And the second was an annual parade as part of Jerusalem Day, which is a celebration by Israelis of the capture of the entire city and what they call the reunification of Jerusalem in 1967. This parade, where you have tens of thousands of people waving blue and white Israeli flags, walking down the street, usually it gets routed through Damascus Gate and right through the Muslim quarter of the old city, as they make their way down to the Western Wall. And in previous events, has seen people on the parade banging on the doors of Arab homes, harassing them, calling out racist chants. And so during a time when there was already a huge amount of tension, this event was due to go ahead. And I was at the Old City when the parade was due to start. And it was only at the very last minute that I noticed two trucks were driven across the road by police to block the route. And a sort of last-minute decision had been made to reroute the parade away from the Muslim quarter.
Did that rerouting help to de-escalate tensions at all, or was it too late?
I think by that point, it was way too late. Too many things have happened. Rerouting a parade is not going to placate the Palestinians of East Jerusalem, who have faced nightly confrontations with Israeli police in riot gear, who have come in to push them away from gathering during Ramadan. So it certainly seemed like it was way too late. Even before dawn, there were clashes between protesters and Israeli police at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And then later in the morning, the Israeli police stormed the compound and people hid within the mosque. That kind of set the tone for what would turn out to be a lot of violence throughout the day.
Hamas, the Islamist militant group that controls Gaza, issued an ultimatum to the Israeli government on Monday to stand down their forces at Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Sheikh Jarrah neighbourhood. What happened next?
So the ultimatum from Hamas was for 6 p.m. At that point, I had left a parade and I sat in a park under a tree with my laptop out and I was writing a story. And I think it was 6:02 or 6:03 and suddenly I hear air raid sirens. There are thousands of people on the parade around me and I notice they all sort of run over to walls and under trees. And then a few seconds later, you just heard sort of four deep thuds, which could have either been those rockets landing or interception by Israel's Iron Dome system, which takes down rockets in the air. And then a few minutes passed and people got back to it. They walked back out into the streets and started the parade again.
Where had these rockets come from?
They were fired from Gaza. And they were kind of the opening shot of what has been an extremely intense bout of fighting between militants in Gaza who fired hundreds of rockets into Israel. And then the sort of overwhelming Israeli response, which is fighter jets and attack helicopters bombing Gaza, including attacks against Hamas military targets.
Israel says it's going after militant leaders. Some were killed in their homes.
But then there have been missiles fired into residential buildings as well.
By Tuesday morning, two Israelis had died and 28 Palestinians had been killed, some of them children.
This was the funeral of an 11-year-old boy who was killed on Monday. One child among many dead already in the first hours of this conflict.
Did you manage to speak to people on the ground in Gaza about what it was like there?
My colleague Hazem Balusha, who lives in Gaza, has been speaking to people there. He met a man who was from Beit Hanun, which is a town in northern Gaza. And he was outside his home on Monday night and suddenly he started hearing bombardments and he started running. But it was too late for him. He got hit with shrapnel, fractured his arm and he got hit in the eye. So Hazem spoke to him as he sort of lay on a bed. And then he had spoken to other people in Gaza who, like in Israel, had been hiding in their homes all night.
The situation in Gaza was already very desperate before these attacks, wasn't it? This is a thin strip of land with a population of around 2 million people who have lived under a blockade for years, which makes it almost impossible for them to leave. In 2019, we spoke to you on the podcast about how restrictive life is for people there. Do you know what things have been like more recently?
Well, it's hard to tell because I used to be able to go in and out of Gaza in a day. It's only 60 miles from Jerusalem. The pandemic has sort of amplified the blockade because it has been hard or impossible at times for journalists to go in. But people in Gaza have been hopeless for years and years and years. It's really a devastating situation.
Next, Oliver, on the intensification of violence late last week throughout Israel and in Gaza.
Oliver, we spoke to you a couple of days ago in Jerusalem. You're now in Tel Aviv. Why? What's been happening there?
The past couple of days since we last spoke, there's been a serious intensification in not only the rockets and the airstrikes.
As Israel's fire and brimstone rain down on Gaza, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad's rockets roar out of Gaza into Israel.
But there's been severe violence that has just spread throughout the whole of Israel, and this is violence basically between Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish Israelis.
Arabs and Jews who've lived side by side for decades in cities across Israel are now turning on each other.
Many people don't know this, but a fifth of the people who live here are actually Arabs who stayed after the war that surrounded Israel's creation. And they've been living here ever since. And this whole episode has brought out such sort of anger. And there have been some awful things that have happened. Not far from where I am now, there's a place called Bat Yam, and last night there was a large mob of far-right Jewish Israelis, and they surrounded a car and pulled out the driver, assuming him to be an Arab, and beat him for several minutes. He's now in hospital, and there have been other episodes like this around the country. There's been burnt synagogues, there's been shooting attacks, there's just been loads of communal violence.
That's the situation in Israel. What's been happening in Gaza?
Well, Israel has continued to bomb Gaza. They've been bombing high-rise buildings, flattening them completely.
This is a Shrook Tower that has been brought down. I was standing right opposite to it.
We're speaking now on Thursday afternoon, and the death toll in Gaza stands at 72, according to the health ministry, there, including 16 children. And then the rockets have continued to be fired out of Gaza. There have been 7 people in Israel who have died, including a 5-year-old boy who managed to make it to a shelter. But unfortunately, a piece of shrapnel came in through the thinner part of the wall. Both the Israeli military and Palestinian militants in Gaza have continued at a really, really intense rate.
The last time Israel and Hamas were at war was in 2014, but there have been flare-ups since. But this feels particularly volatile, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I moved here in 2018, and I've covered many, I can't even remember how many, bouts of violence between Israel and Hamas. They normally don't last very long. You know, after 24 hours or 48 hours, they die down. But this seems especially volatile. You know, there have been rocket attacks on Jerusalem and on Tel Aviv, which haven't happened since the last war in 2014. And Israel's attacks on Gaza have just been relentless. And the rhetoric that is coming out is that this is just going to continue.
The Israeli military saying it's now expanding its targets for airstrikes, and its ground troops are continuing to amass on its boundary with Gaza.
Israel has this policy of deterrence, they call it, where the idea is if you attack them, they will come back as hard as possible on you.
Yesterday, I told those sons of darkness, the Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists, that their blood is forfeit. And a short while ago, we eliminated top commanders of the Hamas general staff, including the Gaza brigade commander and other commanders. And this is just the beginning. We'll hit them like they've never dreamed possible.
You know, if that policy had worked, then I don't know if I'd be speaking to you now about what's going on.
What has it been like for you reporting on this last couple of days? You said, obviously, you've been in the region a long time.
It's been tough. I mean, I'm currently in Jaffa, which is a neighbourhood just south of Tel Aviv. It's a mixed neighbourhood. It's a nice place, majority Palestinian, where people come to hang out. And driving through, it's completely quiet. You know, the roads have burn marks on them from where people have burnt tyres in protests. People are really scared. There are sort of messages going around on social media saying that far-right Israeli groups should come here because there are Arabs here who they could target. It's a complete change of mood. But that mood belied what was underneath this entire time, which is a huge amount of upset, decades and decades of discrimination against the Arab minority in Israel.
What have we heard, Oliver, from the international community this week?
Calls for de-escalation. There have been various Security Council meetings at the United Nations.
The Secretary General is gravely concerned by the serious escalations in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel.
And then there has been a huge amount of sort of condemnation from allies of the Palestinians and allies of Israel of the other side.
America is interesting in this. Donald Trump had fostered that very close relationship with Israel. He moved the US embassy to Jerusalem. Joe Biden has now spoken to Benjamin Netanyahu and talked about Israel's legitimate right to defend itself. What role, though, does the US play in this conflict?
The US is a very strong ally of Israel. And Biden, he sort of is a continuation of more traditional US policy, which is supporting the right of Palestinians. But there's kind of a limit to how much the US will get involved here.
Oliver, you said to me a couple of days ago that you were hopeful that this situation would de-escalate. How do you feel about that now?
I'm still hopeful. Israel has very little to gain from stepping up its violence, and Hamas has very little to gain. When you look at their actual objectives, Israel's objective is to get rid of Hamas, and Hamas's objective is to end the blockade, and neither of those things are going to happen through what's happening now. So I'm hopeful that maybe some backdoor mediation can allow the two sides to sort of back down from this. But the issue is that they both want to have the last word. It's really a question of, can they show that they've beaten their chests and then walk back down from this? But what is really concerning, and what I think won't go away when the rockets and the airstrikes stop, is what's happened within Israel, you know, that the violence between Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish Israelis has really exposed, like, deep, deep scars that people have tried to hide for a long while. And now they're out, and it feels like the Israeli government has basically lost control.
Oliver, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Since this episode first aired on Friday on The Guardian's Global News podcast, Today in Focus, the violence has continued. So far, at least 10 people in Israel and 148 Palestinians have died, with children making up nearly 30% of the death toll in Gaza, according to officials. On Saturday, Israeli airstrikes took out a 12-story building that had housed US news agency Associated Press, Al Jazeera, and many residential properties. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said attacks on Gaza will continue as long as necessary. Meanwhile, United States President Joe Biden has reaffirmed his strong support for Israel to defend itself and also raised concerns about the safety and security of journalists. To get the latest, you can read our coverage of this escalating crisis at theguardian.com, including that of Oliver Holmes, who you just heard from, who has been reporting on this story from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, plus Hazem Baloucha, who is in Gaza. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Ned Carter-Miles. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. Additional production by Miles Martignoni. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Okay, catch you tomorrow.